Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are back with another episode. Some of you might have picked up our bonus episode this past Monday, and that was where we kind of teased a little bit about what we're going to be talking about tonight with regard to some pretty interesting research that Dr. Joe Holley is involved with. Before we can bring on Joe and have our weather update with Becky, we're going to go ahead and bring Sam in here. Sam, how are things there in Colorado? Things settled down a little bit from the weather standpoint?
No. Every afternoon, I mean, every day we get a severe thunderstorm warning, but it seems to be very localized. So sometimes we get hit, sometimes we don't. There's been a lot of hail around here. I had a client this morning with a dented hood. So I'm going to go to our second podcaster. I don't want to say backup because she's more special than that. Becky DePodwin, what is up in Colorado every day? You know, I'm almost thinking this could be like the Chicken Little thing. Like you hear it so much, you just ignore it. And then suddenly you got baseball-sized hail on your hood.
Yeah, really. It's been quite the last few days out there, all up and down the Front Range. I'm looking at today's storm reports, actually, and it's kind of funny. There's just like a line of hail reports from the southern part of the state all the way to the northern part of the state, right along the Front Range. And then, of course, the other day, there was a crazy hail storm in the Springs area. That was pretty awful.
I saw that, and it what causes that? Is there something about the geography there with the Front Range of the Rockies that causes that type of a storm to form?
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. And I'm going to pull it up because I don't have access. I'm going to give a shout out to someone. His name is Chris Bianchi. He works for Weather Nation in Denver. And he wrote an article for the Denver Post about why storms on the Front Range are so bad in terms of hail. But basically, there's just a lot of instability along the Front Range. And all of the ingredients, especially along the Palmer Divide, kind of come together in this really unique way that allows storms to intensify very quickly right up against the mountains. And so they kind of go up and they're fed a lot of moisture coming in from the south. All the ingredients just come together in that particular location. And so that's why there's often, Colorado was really a hot spot for hail. I had a car totaled by hail when I lived there back in the day. So I'll try and find the tweet to that article. It was really good.
I would love that. I would really like to understand this a lot better, since we deal with it every day. But, yeah. You know, I know that you're going to give us a little bit of the upcoming week, but, you know, I had four NOAA hurricane alerts come at exactly the same time. I'm going, oh, my God.
Hurricane or severe?
Having children. Hurricanes.
Wow.
Hurricanes. This is not here, thank God. This is out in the Atlantic, I assume. You
want to
touch on that, Becky?
Yeah. So technically there's only one subtropical storm in the Atlantic, but there are three storms, two of which are hurricanes in the Pacific. So we'll kind of start east and move west, I guess. So out in the Atlantic, located just off the coast of Nova Scotia, a bit, well, a lot actually, is a subtropical storm Debbie. Not going to be any threat to land. It's what we call fish storms, because really the only thing it impacts is fish and maybe some shipping routes. It's actually more off the coast of St. John, Newfoundland. It's way out to sea. So that's not any impact to land. But if we hop over to the Pacific, right along the coast, sort of just off the southern tip of Baja, California, is Hurricane John. That's a Category 2 hurricane, so sustained winds of 105 miles per hour. Hurricane John is going to move basically northwest, paralleling the coast of Baja California before curving more westerly and moving out into the Pacific. So also not really a threat to land aside from surf, rip currents, things like that. Then we have Christy, which is ways southwest of John. Christy is a tropical storm, also what we call a fish storm, only going to impact some fish, maybe some boats, not really a great if you're sailing out there. Going to move kind of northwest, meander off to the north, no impact. And then you get to Hector. Hector is kind of the big gun out there right now. Category 4, sustained winds of 130, currently located well off the south, to the southeast of the main island of Hawaii. Now, Hector is going to move basically due west, but stay south of Hawaii. There is a tropical storm watch for the Big Island, mainly for rough swell, rip currents, things like that. It may get a little breezy, but for the most part, the worst of the impacts are going to remain away from the island. So there are a lot of storms out there right now, but really not going to have much impact to land, which is good.
Yeah, I know people in Hawaii were really concerned about Hector there for a while, and because it really looked like it was bearing right down on him.
Yeah, that could have made things very interesting, especially given the volcanic activity that's still ongoing there. But it looks like it's gonna miss off to the south, thankfully.
Very good.
And hopefully fascinatingly, it could. There. What's that, Sam?
That's they do strange things sometimes and change direction, but I'm glad it's looking good right now.
Yeah. If Hector survives the next several days, if it will cross the international date line sometime next week. And if it does that, it'll become Typhoon Hector.
Oh, that's right. Huh?
Does it? So it keeps the name, I guess. That's interesting.
It does. There's actually another typhoon in the East Pacific right now. Typhoon Shanshan. That could threaten Japan. So the tropics are quite active right now.
Don't they change direction when they get out?
No, it'll likely just continue heading west. It'll probably eventually curve north, if anything. But it'll probably fizzle at some point, too.
Pretty amazing. What about the heat the things we've got going on in the Northeast and other parts of the country where it's just been so hot for the last few days?
Yeah, tell me about it. Hot and humid. It's going to slowly sort of taper off. We'll have storms off and on the next several days, and the heat will gradually sort of taper. And by taper, I mean it'll go to like the lower to mid 80s instead of the upper 80s. But not really much relief in sight. Nothing really significant anyway. It's still summer, unfortunately. I'm ready for fall.
This is stuff we're kind of used to, but I know in other parts of the world, like in parts of Europe, Portugal and Spain and Greece, that's the extreme heat is something that they're not quite as prepared for, it seems like, as we are here.
Yeah, air conditioning, I think, isn't as big of a thing over there. And in fact, when I was up in eastern Canada this past weekend, like in Quebec City and Montreal, air conditioning isn't a big thing there either, which I found really interesting. So I think in America, we crank up the AC and we kind of just deal. But in countries that don't get this intense heat as often, perhaps, I think they're more caught off guard by it.
Well, we'll have to keep an eye on that.
Yeah. And then Europe could also see some severe storms. Germany and parts of France could see some pretty severe storms over the next day or two as their heat wave comes to an end.
So the thunderstorms and things like that is what you're talking about?
Yeah, like severe storms, hail, slight risk for tornadoes, all of the above. I mean, it's not out of the question for places like Germany. And usually when heat waves like this come to an end, they come to an end with a bang.
Wow. Anything else on the horizon in our country?
I mean, we're still obviously watching the fires, particularly
Yes.
Medicino, I don't want to mispronounce that. I probably am fire. And there's no real relief in sight for that, unfortunately. So that's probably the other major piece of news that we're just concerned and watching is the fires out west. It's an awful season. And it's not even halfway over.
My California friends are working their tails off out there right now. Well, for one thing, I know somebody who's used to heat and humidity, and that would be Dr. Joe. But you've been traveling around so much. Have you even been home, Joe?
Yeah, it's been typical August weather in Memphis. So, heat indexes of over 100 and lots of humidity. So we're ready for a little rainfall.
Yeah, I'm ready for fall. I'm with Becky.
Yes.
I'm done with the heat, done with the storms for a while. So, Joe, we're going to kind of tag on to what we were discussing last week, the training you were doing, and talk a bit about some of the research you're doing. So I'm just going to throw it at you and let you run with it.
Well, thanks, Sam. So, yeah, it's been a busy two or three weeks. It's been about 4.5 days or so doing some cadaver-based research on CPR topics. As you guys know, that's sort of one of my passion areas. So we looked at a wide variety of human cadavers, and what we were trying to evaluate was initially the impact of different types of airways in cardiac arrest. Part of the concern there had to do with not every cardiac arrest is intubated with an endotracheal tube, and many EMS services rely on these sort of non-tracheal airways as a backup or a rescue airway for their failed intubation attempts, et cetera. And so part of the concern was whether or not those airways were as effective in cardiac arrest as an endotracheal tube. And I guess I need to be careful sort of how we define effective there. What we were looking at were two things. One was whether or not or how effectively the airway could make a seal and maintain a vacuum inside the chest. So if you're doing CPR and you're using the impedance threshold device in order for you to realize the benefits of the impedance threshold device, you have to be able to generate a small amount of vacuum inside the chest. And so what we did was to measure the airway pressures while we did a variety of versions of CPR, which included manual CPR by hands, or the way it's, the standard CPR stuff. And then standard manual CPR with the addition of the impedance threshold device, and then looking at mechanical CPR devices, and ultimately active compression, decompression CPR, which we've talked about a little bit on the program before. And the other thing that I've been concerned about for a long time related to the use of these airways in cardiac arrest is, do those airways, because of the way they are designed, do they potentially press on or put pressure on or increase the pressure in the carotid arteries and in essence cause some obstruction to blood flow into the brain during CPR? So the concern there is fairly obvious. If we're trying to do good quality CPR, obviously part of that is that we need to make certain that we are flowing blood into the brain. And if the devices and techniques that we are using are hampering that, then clearly we're not reaping the benefits of additional technology, et cetera, and we're actually not doing the best we can for our patients. So that was sort of the driving question behind several intensive days of research related to looking at those problems. So let me stop for just a second, just to make sure there's no questions and everybody's kind of stayed up, caught up with me as far as what we've been talking about. Any questions about anything I've said so far?
Actually, I have one, Joe.
Go ahead, Jamie.
You're talking about You're talking about the maintenance of the pressure gradient, the decreased pressure inside the thoracic cavity, maintaining that slight bit of vacuum using the impedance threshold device. Does that also help facilitate venous return, or are you really just looking at the advent of things like the pressures on the carotid artery?
Well, so I think that's an excellent question, Jamie, and there's a lot of answers to it, quite honestly. The need to generate vacuum or negative pressure inside the chest, it appears to be vitally important to high-quality CPR. It really does two things. The generation of a vacuum inside the chest does sort of the opposite of what CPAP or positive pressure in the chest would do. Obviously, positive pressure is going to try to push everything out of the chest from, you know, air to blood, and is also going to create a pressure gradient between the inside of the chest and the rest of the body. So if you are compressing the chest or you are positive pressure ventilating someone, you generate a positive pressure inside their chest, but the pressure in the rest of their system is effectively zero. So when you release the compression, when you go to the relaxation phase of standard CPR, or you complete that positive pressure breath, the pressure in the chest goes back to basically zero. And the pressure elsewhere is still zero as well. And so you don't get a pressure gradient helping to return blood into the chest to fill up the heart. And you also don't get a pressure gradient to help drain blood out of the brain, which is vitally important because most of the blood that's in our brain is venous and obviously does nothing to enhance oxygenation and removal of waste products and all that sort of stuff. So if you can generate a vacuum inside the chest, you help to pull blood into the chest because the pressure in the chest is now lower than the rest of the body. And that pulls blood back into the chest, but that also pulls blood out of the head. And that helps you to fill up the heart more so that when you compress it the next time, you have more blood to pump. But it also tends to sort of unplug the head a little bit so that you have drained the venous blood out of the head and allowed more room for arterial blood to flow in. So the generation of vacuum in the chest, that's how it enhances CPR in, you know, sort of on both sides, both from the improvement in cardiac output, but also the improvement in cerebral blood flow.
With all this new equipment, it's not only a matter of does it work effectively and understanding how it works effectively, but knowing how to use it. And some of the stuff you're talking about, is it actually creating a problem? So it's become much more complex, but yet it's much better for the patient, but it's taken all this research to get there.
Well, I think you're exactly right. And, you know, one of the things that we have been somewhat concerned about is since these non-tracheal airways have a, you know, are pretty commonplace in EMS and are certainly used a fair amount of the time, particularly in cardiac arrest situations. You know, we worried that these adjuncts that are helping to create vacuum inside the chest and, you know, fill up the heart, and drain the head and all that sort of stuff. Obviously, if the airway can't maintain a seal, in other words, can't hold in the vacuum, then all those adjuncts in the world are going to make no difference at all. And so for some services who may have added adjuncts like the impedance threshold device and seen sort of no change or no significant change in their cardiac arrest survival statistics, et cetera, maybe the reason is not that the impedance threshold device wasn't doing what it was supposed to do, but instead their choice of airway was having an impact on how well that device could function. And they were effectively losing that vacuum through the use of a particular airway or a technique in how it was placed or some other something that was affecting overall the ability to sort of seal off the system enough to generate and maintain a slight vacuum inside the chest.
Wow. So what do you think, Becky? Is this all Greek to a meteorologist, or is it making sense?
Completely Greek, but I'm fascinated just the same.
But yes, it is. Becky will certainly understand the power of pressures and what happens when there's a pressure differential.
Yes. You did say gradient.
Same thing happens in the human body. Exactly. Same thing happens in the human body as it does in the weather, right? You got an area of high pressure, an area of low pressure, and stuff flows from high pressure to low pressure.
Yeah,
that's how it works.
That's fascinating. It's a good comparison.
Yeah, it's a universal truth. I mean, you know.
So, Joe, I have a question for you.
Wow, meteorological connection.
Can you give us an example of how one would maintain a better seal versus a lesser seal with different types of airways? I mean, can you maintain a good seal even doing something like a BLS airway technique, such as a bag valve mask?
Yeah, that's a great question again, Jamie. So the answer is yes. You can create and maintain a vacuum with something as simple as a bag valve mask. It's a challenge to do so, and in general, in my experience, and certainly sort of reproducing that in our lab, it seems quite apparent that that's a two-man job. You need one person who does nothing but maintain the seal of the mask to the face, and another who's handling utilization of bag valve mask, the bag itself. Sorry. So it can work with bag valve mask. It can work with endotracheal tube. It can work with these supraglottic airways as well. I think part of the challenge with supraglottic airways is that they are sort of by design these kind of blind insertion devices, you know, with the idea that you just sort of put them down the throat and they sort of magically go to the right spot. And then you don't have to worry about it much anymore after that. And we learned that that's probably not true at all. It's certainly more true with some devices than it is with others. And so I think part of what we learned is that if you are frequently utilizing these non-tracheal airways in your cardiac arrest resuscitation, you need to pay very close attention to how the device is inserted. You may well need to fiddle with and reposition the device frequently in order to maintain a seal. Some devices are going to struggle maintaining a seal at all. But in most cases, the recognition that you don't have a seal is fairly straightforward. And I mean, I say that, you know, based on a nice quiet room in a laboratory setting where we can hear quite well, and you can actually hear air leaking and, you know, air slipping past the device and all that sort of stuff. In the field, that's going to be a much more challenging situation when there's lots your ability to appreciate those kind of subtle differences is not as easily undertaken. So I think that's certainly one caveat for folks to pay very close attention to, and to realize that the devices, they're definitely not all made equally in regards to their ability to consistently make and maintain a seal. They all can do the job, but there's a lot of variability between devices. So I think it's important that folks are paying close attention to what they're using, how they're using it, and the need to be certain that you
speaking of education, what is the best way for basic providers to learn this, all the complexities of this?
Wow, that's a great question too, Sam. I don't know that I have the answer to that. I can tell you over the course of those 4 days, I placed and replaced, you know, probably 250 different airway insertions in, you know, a variety of patients, and really came to appreciate how easy some go sort of to the right place, and how others are much more of a struggle to get to the right place, and that the ability to recognize that can be very challenging. I think trying to teach somebody to do that is clearly experiential. And what that may mean is that we need to be paying much more attention to I don't want to say a basic skill, because I'm not really sure this is a basic skill, but I think that EMS has been working under the assumption that these blind insertion non-tracheal airway devices are sort of super simple and they're for the guys that have trouble getting the endotracheal tube in, or an endotracheal intubation is outside their scope of practice, so like an advanced ENT or something, who really needs it. It's clear to me it's even more important understand those subtle differences at the at levels less than paramedic, and for folks that don't tend to use those airway devices very often, because they are at least as challenging as tracheal tube to do well and to maintain a seal with, especially when you're actively doing CPR on a patient and you're moving them around. And that sort of stuff. So I guess the biggest concern I have right now is that we have a lot of people using these devices with not a great depth of appreciation and understanding for the limitations and challenges that those devices present.
Wow. Jamie, would you agree this is not your mother's CPR?
Well, I would, and just because, you know, airway has been one of those hot-button items for many years now. You know, when is an advanced airway appropriate? When is it not appropriate? That's why I asked the question about, you know, a simple BLS airway or bag valve mask, maintaining that seal with that device, and how it we would go about doing that. You know, Joe, when I'd like to talk a little bit about methodology, because putting a study like this together, we're still waiting for some of the results to come together and the data to be analyzed completely. But just the front end of putting something like this together has got to be daunting. How did you kind of narrow down what you were going to be looking at, and how did you bring together the various parts to control the variables necessary to make this a viable study?
Well, you're exactly right. This proved to be a logistically very challenging study to do. Our original question was really focused on my concerns related to carotid blood flow, and we realized that we were going to have it was going to be really challenging to try to measure that, and that the pressure differentials and flow differentials might well be quite small. And so precise measurement was going to be important, as well as a fairly large number of measurements in a variety of circumstances, so that we had, you know, lots of numbers to crunch to make certain that the results that we ultimately generated were statistically significant in the way we did that. So it sort of morphed from there into also looking at the concept of being able to form the seal, because that was an equally significant problem that we thought was out there. And we realized that that had the potential to actually be easier to recognize in a clinical setting without the instrumentation that we had in place that allowed us to record, you know, pressure curves and all that kind of stuff. So we began to think of both those questions in a similar light, with the idea that maybe if we can answer one or either of those, both of those questions will benefit from the information that we learn. So our approach to that was to utilize a number of fresh human cadavers that we instrumented initially, and we need to be clear, we used a variety of sizes and sexes and, you know, facial structure and airway structure and body habitus and everything else to ensure that we had a fairly wide representation of mankind. And we instrumented those cadavers by putting pressure-sensitive catheters that could measure pressure changes and pressure curves and all that sort of stuff. We placed one in the proximal aorta. We placed another in the left carotid, as far up the left carotid as we were able to get it before it goes into the skull. We placed the pressure monitor so that we could know what intracranial pressure was at all times, and then the airway pressure peak as well. Then we randomized the airways as far as which one we started with and which one came next, so that we always did it in a different order on every cadaver. We started each one with an endotracheal tube just to sort of use that as our baseline, because we knew we could make a seal and we had data on other studies that, you know, let us know that we definitely could make a seal there and that wasn't a problem. So we started with an endotracheal tube. We randomly went through the different airways based on the manufacturer's recommended size for that specimen. And we would place the airway, and then we would perform CPR in a number of different ways, from standard manual CPR to mechanical CPR to active compression decompression CPR to heads up CPR, multiple iterations of each, while we measured pressures and all the stuff that we were measuring there. So each cadaver took about 4 hours to cycle through all of the different airways and all of those different forms or iterations of CPR with each airway. And then at the end of that, when we had been through every non-tracheal airway that we were using, we put the endotracheal tube back in place and rechecked, sort of did one more round of CPR, because we wanted to know, was there a difference in what we were seeing from the beginning of the study till the end of the study, in that we've been doing CPR on this cadaver for 3.5 hours. And we wanted to make sure if we were having, you know, changes in chest wall compliance and those kind of things, that, you know, what did it look like at the end, so that we could at least have a you know, a sense of it changed a lot or it didn't change much at all, just again for comparison purposes. So we did that whole thing multiple times over with all different sizes and sections of cadavers and all those different airways, again in a different order every time. And then we gathered all those numbers together, and we're sort of still in the process of doing some statistical analysis on the pressures that we measured. As a matter of fact, one thing I failed to mention is that we would place an airway and we would measure the static pressure, meaning just the pressure not doing CPR, of the time that we would measure when we put the airway in place. And then if the airway had an inflatable balloon or cuff or whatever, we would inflate that cuff to manufacturer's recommended spot, and we would recheck pressures just with the inflation of the balloon or the cuff. And then we would also, in some cases, could even add a little bit more air in order to make a seal. So we try to measure two different the manufacturer says put this much air into the cuff, and when we did that, we didn't have a good seal. So you could put, you know, 20 cc's more in per the manufacturer's recommendation. So we would do that. Then we get a better seal, and then we'd see what the pressures were there. And then we start doing all the CPR stuff.
That's quite daunting. That's a lot of stuff to be looking at.
I'll have to say my back hurt my back hurt for 3 days after that. It truly was physically very challenging. There were five or six of us in the lab, it was a significant undertaking, to say the least. I see why nobody's done this study before, and that's because it was really hard to do.
You should have done it when you were younger, Joe.
Oh, amen. So right there.
The technology wasn't there, so what are you going to do? I don't know, Jamie. That's a lot of stuff to absorb there, but it's going in a fascinating direction.
Definitely is. And I think, Joe, you know, because we're getting kind of towards the end of our time frame, but is there anything that you'd like to kind of bring up that as a conclusion, or maybe a hint of some of the conclusions you guys are hoping to come together with?
Yeah, I could certainly tell you a few things that we learned. We learned that CPR is much more effective no matter what kind of airway you use, if you use the ITD. I think that was a straightforward caveat. We certainly saw an improvement on mechanical CPR particularly. As far as the airways are concerned, again, we're still kind of crunching those numbers and doing the statistics on those. It appears that the devices that have a larger balloon or cuff on them may have a significantly more difficult time consistently making a seal. And as far as their impact on product blood flow, that one's, I couldn't tell, obviously, that there was a difference. So I think that one's going to be all in the numbers, which hopefully we'll have pretty soon. We have written up an abstract, and we've submitted it to the National Association of EMS Physicians meeting upcoming, and we plan on presenting this data at our big Take Heart America international meeting that'll be in September in California. I would certainly encourage any of the listeners that are interested to please hunt that conference out in California at the end of September and come to that conference. It'll be the first of its kind looking at the future of resuscitation. And I think you'll be really amazed at, one, the quality and the number of amazing speakers that will be there, as well as the information, the data that will be coming out of that meeting. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Sam, it's pretty amazing that we pull together these kind of things and that we've been able to partner with Joe and all the stuff that you're doing, Joe, to bring together this amazing research, the educational things you do on the other side of things with Paragon Medical Education Group. And you know, how does this impact the way that people are going to be teaching CPR and teaching things? Because training is something you're very passionate about, and having the access to the right information is critical to training people to be good clinicians in the field.
Sure. I think that we've already begun incorporating some of this stuff into some of the Paragon training that we're doing as part of some of our we talked about it briefly, a lab in Oxford, Mississippi, the home of Ole Miss, just about a week ago. We incorporated a lot of this education into that, and we're able to actually show people that physiology. and we'll be doing the same thing in Birmingham, Alabama, in about 2 weeks, if I remember right. So we've got a big lab coming up over there. But I think that, you know, the goal is to really show people what's actually happening during CPR so that they understand the changes that they're making in a patient, and they understand the physiology so that they know when things make sense to work, and they can actually see it. So I think it's got to be very experientially based.
If folks want to find out more about what Paragon does, I know we haven't really talked about the types of disaster training you guys do, but as you mentioned, you're already starting to put these things, some of this other clinical information into effect in your training. This is a good example of the type of real-life clinical applications that you bring to the training stage when you come into an area. Where can they reach out to you to find out more?
Well, we're on the web at ParagonMedicalGroup.com. You can certainly find us on Facebook under the same name, Paragon Medical Group, and always can reach out to us through the Disaster Podcast.
And thank you, Joe. We appreciate it. This has been a very informative episode, so thanks for taking the time. I know you're on the road driving, and it's always we always appreciate when you're able to give us some of your valuable time for something like this.
Well, I loved talking about it, and you know, I think it's yet another kind of area that Paragon really excels at, is the ability to, you know, if you want the best CPR teaching in the world, I'm confident that we are currently delivering that, and I realize that's no small thing to say, but the ability to show this physiology to folks and the impact of these various techniques and adjuncts to CPR is beyond words in its impact. And I feel so passionate about that I just love for everybody to want to, you know, bring us in and let's do a CPR lab, if nothing else.
We'll definitely have to keep in touch, and folks can find links on disasterpodcast.com and elsewhere. Please follow up and get in touch with the folks at Paragon. Becky, I know you've been listening in and trying to soak some of this up, even as a layperson, as a bystander. Doing good, high-quality CPR is important, and understanding the importance of, you know, coming off the chest at the end of the compression to increase that decreased level of pressure in the chest is so important, and that's what Joe was talking about. But we want to talk about the weather, too, and that's part of our show every week. So where can folks find more about what you do and connect with you online?
So I'm mainly found on Twitter at @WX_BECKS. I discuss lots of things, weather, emergency management, crisis risk communication. I'm actually looking to take CPR classes and become certified. So this is actually really informative and really fascinating to me, and kind of a good intro for all of that. So thanks, Joe.
It's good. And thank you for being available to be on tonight. I know you just got back from a fabulous vacation. And so kind of getting back into the saddle of things at work and life in general. But thanks for taking some time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on, guys. I always enjoy it.
Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, the usual social media places, Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, Twitter, Facebook, whatever else is out there. The Facebook page, which we didn't mention yet, and we got a lot of stuff going on over there, and certainly the disasterpodcast.com website. What about you, Jamie?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations out there. Please friend, follow, or otherwise catch up with me there. And of course, you can find me active in our page, or actually Facebook group. Just search for Disaster Podcast. Request to join the group. We'd love to have you in there. And we want to have you join the conversation. We often have our guests on there actively talking and responding to questions in the episodes that they're on, and you can take part in those conversations as well. When questions arise, you can just head over there and ask the question right there on the group. So please do that. Please stay involved, and we'll keep doing the same on our end. You know, Sam, we've talked a lot about emergency medical practices here in this episode, but it doesn't change the way we are going to handle things from a disaster standpoint. We're still dealing with medical emergencies and doing them in a very real way.
You bet. And disasters are at many different levels. And for a family, that's a very personal disaster. So we need to give it the best we can when we're trying to resuscitate somebody. But, you know, this is a different spin on it. But, you know, disaster education is not our everyday education.